This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It's hard to imagine. Will you decide to move, to leave your home because of climate change? Maybe relentless heat becomes too much. Fires could burn you out, or floods come so often there's no money to rebuild. It might just be one too many awful storms. Crops could fail, goosing food prices ridiculously high, busting the local economy. Animals, plants, and fish are already moving either towards the poles or to higher ground. Humans, for all our technology, may not be exempt. Some of you, I know, are already wondering if that's in your future, too. Our first guest says it will happen. That's Giles Slade, author of American Exodus. He's talking about millions of Americans and Latin Americans seeking greener pastures, or at least cooler ones, in Canada and Alaska. The Canadians may simply move even further north. The same future has been predicted by British scientist Sir James Lovelock. He sees the ocean-wrapped British Isles becoming a destination point for North Africans and people from Southern Europe as great deserts form there. Look out Scandinavia and Siberia for the same reasons. This may not happen this year or even this decade, but we are going to talk about it. Then climate scientist Paul Beckwith returns with a startling new NASA study about Arctic ice melt. That change, not just our car burning, that change is producing about one quarter of all global warming. How will that shift science and climate activism? Worried about methane leaks in the Arctic? We wrap up with another new survey of natural gas leaks right in major American cities, this time in Boston and Washington, D.C. Measurements show our big cities are also big methane sources, and that's something the natural gas salespeople don't tell you when they promise to be better than coal. Ready? I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock.
Tell the boys to ride. All right, boys, let's head out.
Maybe after a cold winter, some gritty, sweaty summers sound pretty good, as long as the power stays on with air conditioners running. But then food gets too expensive or runs out, or maybe you can't get insurance after that next flood, storm, or fire, and you've got no money to rebuild. So it's time. It's time to move the family somewhere cooler with regular rain. It's time to move to New Zealand, to Scandinavia, or to Canada. What if a few million others go the same route? Our next guest, Giles Slade, thinks it will happen. A massive migration driven by climate change and a fallen economy. Millions of Americans, and maybe Latin Americans, will move north. Greg Slade is an award-winning author with his works about consumption and planned obsolescence from his home on the west coast of Canada. He joins us now to talk about his book, American Exodus, Climate Change, and the Coming Flight for Survival. Giles, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, thank you very much.
What prompted you to write this book?
Well, I'm getting a bit older. I'm 60 now, and I have three boys, and I started wondering what their life was going to be like in the coming century, and especially in the next 20 to 30 years. And the more I sort of looked into it, the darker their future sort of looked to me. So I thought I should let people know about it.
Well, you know, as another Canadian, I can say we're always nervous about that American giant next door. Is it possible you're expressing just another Canuck moment of paranoia?
No, I don't think it's knee-jerk anti-Americanism. I think, I lived in the United States for a long time. I lived in Los Angeles, and it seems to me that when I was there in 82, that there was this great influx of Mexicans into the United States. And for a long time, I was sort of perplexed about it. And when I started to look at these issues, I started to realize that that's part of an economic migration, economic and environmental migration, sort of like the Dust Bowl that's happening in the United States right now. So, I don't think it's just knee-jerk anti-Americanism.
Good. Let's talk about this earlier example of Americans on the move. Talk to us about the Okies and California and the Dust Bowl of the Great Depression back in the 30s.
Right. Well, there was, a massive La Nina during the 30s, like the La Nina that's happening now, but the one, I guess, that's happening now is larger and is going to last longer. And it dehydrated the plains at the time when they were using, you know, power farming for the first time. And so they dug up their soil at the time when they had these really dry, hot winds. And the soil just blew away, wrecked farming for everyone, destroyed the water supply, and I think 2.5 million people left the plains during that decade. And a lot of them went to California.
And how were they received there?
Very, very badly. And I think that's the first lesson. You know, if you're a climate migrant, you're not going to be welcomed. If you're a climate migrant, you're going to be traveling in a lot of company, and you're not going to be welcomed in the place that you go. They're not going to have the infrastructure for you, and they're going to see you as a threat to their economy.
There were even laws banning them from going to certain establishments, and you had to stay in camps, and the police guarded around the camps. It wasn't pleasant at all, and that happened right in America, the home of democracy.
Yeah, and it more or less happens every time that there is a really large disaster, like Hurricane Katrina. You know, I don't think it was any mistake at all that FEMA didn't help the victims of Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. I think it's more or less the rule. There's a case of sort of blaming the victim and kind of stigmatizing people for their suffering, which is, it's kind of archetypal and almost biblical, but it's what happens every time. You know, if you were a good person, you wouldn't have been victimized in this way.
And you mentioned Mexico. The population of Mexico has doubled since 1950. Their land hasn't doubled. It's still climbing. Yet every climate model shows Mexico getting unbearably hot and dry. The desert's expanding. What do you see happening with that?
Well, I think a lot more Mexican and Central American migrants will be pouring into the United States. But already, you know, a quarter of the country lives, eats, sleeps, and works in the United States. So there's in excess of 25 million Mexicans. There's about 110 Mexicans in total. It's changed the demographic structure of the United States. It's changed, the linguistic structure of the United States. And I just think that will keep happening.
Are there some states already losing people?
California has had negative migration for the past 10 years, but I think this current year, which is the worst year of drought for California in the last 500 years, you'll see a lot more than the 250 or 500,000 people that have been pouring out of the state. I think areas all through the Southwest where water is becoming, you know, a really the most important resource will start having negative migration.
Have the people like NSA and other U.S. government agencies, have they seen this coming? Are they talking about it?
Yeah, there are climate change study institutes that have prepared reports for the United States. And this climate migration from the United States into Canada is one of the mid-range scenarios. So it's not either extreme end. It's something that they've seen as long as, you know, 5 or 10 years ago. And the thing is that there has been no preparation in Canada about it, and we're just beginning to have the discussion here. People are just beginning to talk about the. I think there's a professor Ticaro at Simon Fraser University who talks about the effects of climate migration on British Columbia.
Well, how do you see the pressures of climate change meshing with worries about an economic collapse? Might they both combine to drive people into outward migration?
Yes, and in fact, there's an economic historian called Sing-Si Chu, I think it's Oberlin College in California, who says that this is exactly what always happens. The two go together. There's an economic collapse and an environmental collapse, and people migrate for this reason. And he has, you know, numerous examples like the Anasazi. What I guess will happen is that, you know, as each superstorm sort of hits New York City, I think Superstorm Sandy cost $80 billion, but they will be happening in greater frequency. And after you've spent $80 billion to repair the infrastructure maybe 2, 3, 4 times, you start to consider, wouldn't it be wiser if we just moved? Wouldn't it be cheaper, wiser if we just moved the industry and people to higher ground?
Right, sort of a local climate flight away from the shores of the ocean and from rivers. And we can see people in the UK definitely considering that as they get flooded out in those regions. Now, looking back in history, the great migration from Europe to North America, there were companies who advertised and provided the ships and the passage. It was more or less organized. Do you see that happening in this case?
from the United States into Canada.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's going to be, at first, I think it's going to be a very disorganized affair. I think there needs to be an international conversation about how to achieve this kind of migration and how to prepare for it. I don't think that's happened, and I don't think there's the political will for it. So I think at first, certainly people will move on their own, and it will be a huge disorganized mess.
My personal opinion is the rich will move first. They might just buy an extra house with lots of preparation in Canada in case they need it. And then poorer people with very few choices may take to the roads. We could end up with something like Cormac McCarthy's book, The Road. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, exactly. And you know, the scenario you've just outlined is actually what happens. People with better financial resources make their choices earlier and quicker. So before Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, there had been ample warning, and people with access to cars, left New Orleans, the middle class, the upper middle class. So the people who were left in the center of the city were people who didn't have access to cars, couldn't make those kinds of economic choices. And they're the ones who become most desperate and have to make the most desperate choices. And I think that's a very telling kind of example.
Well, Greg Slade, as you know, a lot of Americans are very patriotic. They love the place where they live. It would be heartbreaking to leave your home. It's going to take a lot to make the move to another country, don't you think?
Yeah, except, there's a very strange relationship between Canada and the United States that I found when I used to live there. And, very warmly welcomed in California. I think they felt that, we were just, one of the colonies that was too illiterate to read the invitation to the big party back in 1776, And so it's something that was supposed to happen with manifest destiny and just didn't happen for a lot of historical accidents. So I don't think... Canada is not as foreign to the United States as, say, Mexico is.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with Giles Slade, author of American Exodus, Climate Change, and the Coming Flight for Survival. I want to talk about this idea of safe places to go. James Lovelock pictured Britain as an island cooled by surrounding seas, and he said that the government there should get started right now building schools and hospitals to serve the millions of climate refugees who will come. But is any preparation possible, and have you heard anything from the Canadian government on this?
Nothing at all from the Canadian government. I think, it's very difficult for the current Canadian government to say that we're going to prepare for climate change and still maintain its status as a petrostate, So there's a kind of irony there. But in Russia, I know for certain that they're preparing the infrastructure of Siberia to accept many tens of thousands of migrants in the coming decades. So this has already happened, I guess, in Asia. We just haven't followed suit.
Well, I think despite the borders, it's quite possible that China will make a colony out of Siberia as people move north out of there. We'll have to see. Nobody knows. But getting back to North America, the infrastructure, things like water, sewage, housing, they're already pretty poorly developed in Canada's north and in Alaska. Look what's happening in Fort McMurray with the tar sands, for example. Is the north ready?
No, I don't think so, but the north is a particularly good place to go, and especially here on the west coast where there are, extremely fertile places like the Stikine Valley that, is compared to, the African veldt. I think we'll have 30% to 40% more water in the coming century because of the winds sweeping across the Pacific and dumping water on the western side of our mountains. And for that reason, we'll be rich in a way that most of the rest of the world is not. Water will be the new gold.
Years ago, a fellow named Dan Bloom in Taiwan started sending me plans for solar cities. He was inspired by James Lovelock's vision of the last humans making a stand around a tropical Arctic ocean. That's centuries away if it happens. But as Canadians, we know there's very little soil on those rocks up there. It's quite acidic. We'll never replace the great wheat and corn belts. So are we talking about a population crash as well, really?
I think so. I think we're at a moment where, a population scientist, which population scientist described as the bottleneck. And I think it doesn't have to happen in this way, but there's no political will that has developed to prevent it. So I think it will, in fact, happen. And our population will be, which is artificially sustained by a lot of, a lot of petroleum products, our population will shrink dramatically in the next 50 years.
What kind of reactions are you getting from Canadians about your book and this idea?
Well, I don't know. I think about 30% of Canadians think that I'm insane. And you know, and 70% seem to sit back and say, boy, that's really interesting. I'm getting really positive reactions from Americans who I think have changed their minds about climate change and have changed their minds about how climate change has been misrepresented to them and are beginning to experience these extreme weather events that are happening with greater frequency with real foreboding.
I'm thinking about the people in Texas who have gone through like 3 to 6 months of times when it's over 30 degrees and it doesn't cool off much at night, or people in Kansas who can't grow their gardens anymore. Those people are going to come.
Yeah, absolutely. They're going to leave the Southwest for sure and very, very shortly. And then they may work their way north in a sort of staged migration. There are a lot of species like songbirds that are now having their winter homes, you know, 300 to 400 miles further north than they did 20 years ago. I think the most common reaction to climate change is migration, and human beings aren't exempt from it at all. That's what I try to show in my book, you know, with these historical examples of the Dust Bowl and Hurricane Katrina and I guess the Mexican crisis, is that, we're already doing it, actually.
And I wonder if this fear of a mass migration, whether it's rational or not, will cause more Canadians to buy guns, for example. There's all kinds of unpredictable social consequences, even from thinking about these ideas in your book, American Exodus. Don't you find just talking about this stirs up all kinds of emotions?
Yeah, and I think, that may be a good thing, because we've put our emotional reaction to climate change on the back burner smoke has been blown in our eyes over the past 20 to 30 years. But I don't think buying guns is not a solution. You know, you should prepare yourself and your family for a safe, planned sort of exit to a better place. Cooler climes and higher ground are really what you're looking for, and that's what I'm looking for as I contemplate selling my home in Richmond.
Climate change, you know, many of the people that are listeners to this program, they're pushing local food production for more resilience. What happens when an extra couple of hundred people show up around the campfire or at the kitchen door?
Yeah, well, exactly what you'd imagine would happen. A lot of people go hungry and a lot of people die, and people who possess the resources, you know, are pretty cheap with them when they come to sharing them out with new people who don't have any, I guess, social capital in that locality. When people come to a new region and need help, I guess the politicians and the people of that region are traditionally very parsimonious with their resources and full of resentment towards the new people who are taking their resources. And I think this is exactly what happened with the Okies in California, and it's exactly what happened, after Hurricane Katrina, and it's what's happening in the United States with the Mexicans who come out of their dried Sonoran desert and looking for food and jobs in the United States. And I don't think there's going to be a huge welcome for Americans in Canada, but I don't think that, there are 350 million Americans, there are only 35 million Canadians. I don't think we can turn them back at the door.
Well, Giles Slade, help me picture this. What kind of climate shock would really fuel this exodus? Or will it be a million little decisions during years of grinding heat and storms? Well, how do you see it?
I think in different regions there will be different events. I think, maybe two Superstorm Sandys in a season would pretty well empty out the east coast of the United States. I think, a few more years of drought will empty out the Southwest definitively, including California. And riverine flooding, if it continues as it did in Colorado, this past fall, or even Calgary, will convince a lot of people who live near the rivers of the Midwest that it's not a very habitable place anymore. The carrying capacity has been radically reduced, and they'll start looking for, places where the quality of life is better. But there are economic concerns as well. Young people have more debt now than they've ever had at any point in the history of the United States, and a fresh beginning in a better place where there's better quality of life will be very attractive.
All right, so what are you working on now? What's your next project?
Right now I'm working on selling my house, but I do have a book in mind, but I'm just going to hold on to it for a while.
Okay, and is there a website or a Facebook page where people can go to find out more about your book on American Exodus?
Well, the New Society Publishers, my publisher, has a website, and you can go there, or you can go to my author page, Giles Slade, on Amazon.com.
Okay. The book is American Exodus, Climate Change and the Coming Flight for Survival. It's from New Society Publishers. We've been talking with the author, Giles Slade. Thanks, Giles, even if it is a little bit of bad news about our future.
Thank you so much. It's good to have me on.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. When there's big news about the Arctic sea ice, and there is, who else to call but Paul Beckwith? He's the double master's man working on his PhD in climatology at the University of Ottawa. Paul has been watching the Arctic ice closely for years. Paul Beckwith, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex.
There is big news about the Arctic, although I suppose it's not really news to you and maybe not even to me, but tell us what NASA is reporting, please.
Well, very recently, NASA, a SIRS satellite has been recording the albedo. So the albedo is basically the percentage of reflected light from a surface. And satellites have been recording data since 1979. And the Arctic reflectivity of the whole region was about 52%. And more recently, in 2011, I believe, the reflectivity of the Arctic has dropped to 48%. So the Arctic is getting darker, so it's absorbing more light. And this is one of the prime reasons that the Arctic temperature is amplified at much, much higher rates than that of the global average.
Well, look, this idea that it's dropped from 52% in 1979 to 48% in 2011, that doesn't sound like such a big deal. It's just 4%. Why is NASA coming out and reporting this?
The change in reflectivity is 4%, but if you take it in terms of, you know, when we normally think of percentages, a change from 52 to 48 is actually a change of 8%, and I'm not talking about reflectivity here. I'm just talking about normal percentages. So, you know, 8% is approaching 10%. This represents an additional forcing to the climate system, a forcing making the temperature rise. And if you average the Arctic effect over the entire planet and compare it to the rise of temperature, the forcing from CO2 emissions into the atmosphere since 79 to 2011, then this reflectivity drop in the Arctic represents about a quarter of the effect of the CO2. So the CO2 has caused, say, 1 unit of warming since 79 to 2011, and the Arctic albedo change has caused 0.25 or 25% of the warming. So it's a very significant factor. It's higher than a lot of scientists and NASA people have expected. But being a member of AMEG, we carried out these calculations several years ago, and it's no surprise to us. I mean, it's part of the reason why we're so concerned about the changes in the Arctic and how that will affect the global changes.
Well, yes, you raised the Arctic Methane Emergency Group, or AMEG, and that includes the ice specialist Peter Wadhams at Cambridge. He's quite famous for his work. And you've been ringing the alarm bells about the importance of dwindling ice cover for years. And most of us have experienced this recently, though, Paul, as changes in the jet stream bringing extreme weather events in North America, Europe, and Asia. As a bit of a sidelight, could you run us through that quickly again?
Yes. So humans have changed the chemistry of the atmosphere. Our emissions from fossil fuel combustion have added greenhouse gases. So we've changed the physical chemistry of the atmosphere. So the atmosphere is absorbing a lot more heat, and the temperature is rising, but the temperature doesn't rise uniformly. The temperature change in the equatorial regions is relatively small. The temperature rises in the Arctic, high Arctic, are much, much larger, 5, 6, 7, 8 times higher than the global average. Land temperatures are rising more than ocean temperatures. So there's variability, you know, about the average, of course. The key factor that is changing is the temperature gradient between the equator and the North Pole. And because that temperature gradient is decreasing, so the temperature, when you have a temperature gradient, it determines heat flow. So heat always flows from hot areas to cold areas. And if the temperature difference is larger, there's more heat flow. So the heat wants to flow from the equator to the Arctic via the atmospheric wind patterns, circulation patterns, and also by ocean currents. So because that temperature gradient has decreased between the Arctic and North Pole, then there's less heat flowing from the equator to the North Pole. So the jet streams, and whenever air moves in the northern hemisphere, it deflects right because of the rotation of the Earth, something called the Coriolis force. So the jet streams are formed because of that heat flow northward, and because there's less heat flow northward, there's less volume in the jet stream. So the jet streams, that can be reflected by a decrease in cross-sectional area of the jet streams or decrease in speed or both. So what we're seeing is a decrease in speed, and because the speed is decreasing, because of conservation of angular momentum, some physics, the jet streams have to become slow down, become curvier, and their location is more dependent on land-ocean contrast. So the jet streams are becoming very broken up and fractured and very, very wavy. This is leading to different weather conditions. So the statistics of the climate have changed, and the weather events all occur within that system, so they are changing. And because of the overall warming, there's about 4 or 5% more water vapor in the atmosphere than there was in 79. So this is also more water vapor in the air. When it condenses to form clouds, it releases the energy. So there's more energy in the atmosphere, and the storms are moving slowly, and they're tracking to different locations as they follow the jet streams, which are in different locations.
Yes, for the poor people in Britain, they know that very well, and it's very unevenly distributed. I mean, California's dry and Britain is soaked. But this new study, if I understand it correctly, it means a lot more than just unstable or bad weather further south. If you're talking about a quarter of all the forces that we generate by fossil fuel emissions, you're talking about global impacts, a completely changing climate.
Yes, this is the key issue. I mean, we've changed the properties of different locations of the Earth to light. We've changed the albedo is the reflectivity. So we've changed the distribution of temperatures. So it's no surprise that the weather is also changing. I mean, I'm very convinced that we've crossed a threshold or tipping point, and we're in early stages of an abrupt climate change event, and it will take us within a decade or two to a much warmer planet, one where there's much less latitudinal temperature change. So in other words, the Arctic will be much, much warmer. The jet streams will be completely configured completely differently, and our climate will be completely changed. And originally, I thought that this would require extremely large methane emissions from the Arctic to swing us this way, and that may still be the case, but I'm not. What I'm seeing, what we're seeing is because of these massive extremes and these massive waves in the jet stream, that's a very, very strong feedback to mix warmer air from further south with the colder air from the Arctic, you know, effectively smearing out the temperature difference between those two regions. So I see the massive cold spells across the U.S. and the very warm temperatures high in the Arctic. We're talking about 20 degrees Celsius positive anomalies above average in the Arctic and 20 degrees C below average anomalies when those people call it the polar vortex came south and visited the U.S. This is a huge mixing of cold air and warm air with latitude. And it does lead to, it's very strong feedback effect in itself.
It shouldn't be happening. Now, getting back to AMIG, you have suggested on this program as well that we need to rescue the sea ice as a priority, if necessary, using geoengineering such as spraying sulfate particles to halt the decline, at least temporarily. Does this new NASA report strengthen your case for that?
Yes, it absolutely strengthens it. You know, this new NASA report has just been out a few days, and there's already been numerous blogs and things on it. And there was one blog in particular that was saying that, like, the NASA measurements are the reflectivity of the whole Arctic, and it was believed at one point that as the sea ice declined and there was more open water, the higher evaporation would lead to more low-level clouds, which reflect light, so would in some way compensate for this loss of albedo change. I mean, that may be occurring. Maybe the loss of reflectivity or albedo from the sea ice is more than the 4%. Maybe some of it's being compensated by more clouds, but the net effect is the 4% of albedo drop. So the article was saying, well, maybe cloud seeding or putting albedo in the Arctic would not help. It doesn't say that the geoengineering methods to brighten the Arctic and reflect more light won't work. It just says it's not happening naturally because of the cloud formation. So I haven't changed any of my position that I had 2 years ago. What I've just seen is that the system is accelerating at an ever faster rate. I mean, the climate system is changing. I mean, I wouldn't have thought that the whole system was undergoing an abrupt change a few years ago, but that's what I see now. And I'm quite prolific with YouTube videos, and I did one of just a few days ago talking about how the extreme weather and the climate, you know, how this is evolving in the future as I see it. You know, what's our planet going to look like in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years?
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with climate scientist Paul Beckwith. You know, Paul, most of climate science, including the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, have been busy calculating, here's so much change for so many barrels of oil or tons of coal burned, and now we find there's a huge feedback from the emerging dark surface of the Arctic Sea. How will that change the emphasis in climate science?
I think that we're nearing a tipping point in public behavior and understanding of climate science, and it is getting to political leaders. I mean, you have people like John Kerry saying that, you know, climate change is a huge, huge threat. You have the military with many reports saying that, you know, climate change is a very strong threat multiplier. You know, a lot of people are getting extremely, extremely concerned about, you know, how, I mean, it's obvious that things are changing very, very quickly. It's obviously that things are not right. And like countries like Britain are bearing the brunt right now, and then it will switch to some other country. You know, think of it as the climate casino, you know, which country is unlucky in the climate casino. I mean, for January and February, it was Britain, you know, as well as many countries in South America where there's been massive flooding. In the U.S., it's the, California. I mean, the food, you know, and how it will affect people, you know, is the food supply. I mean, even in the Ukraine, when there were problems, a number of years ago, and it was the Orange Revolution, food prices had spiked up a lot before that happened. And, you know, when people have trouble paying for food, they go into the streets and they, you know, demand change from the government. I don't know, you know, the situation enough there to say that this is the same sort of thing, but I know it happened with the Orange Revolution in the Ukraine a number of years ago. So, you know, there's a lot of we should probably have a separate session on geopolitics.
Absolutely. You know, I do want to get into one thing that you've kind of brought up, which is where could we go? And my guest this week, author Giles Slade, says that birds and fish are starting to move northward towards the poles, and humans will start that trek as well within our lifetimes. He thinks there will be an exodus from Southern America into Canada as climate refugees, and maybe from Africa and the Middle East towards Scandinavia, Britain, or Siberia. What do you think? Is he going too far or too fast when he talks like that?
No, I mean, we definitely see animals migrating. Plants and animals, flora and fauna, they're used to a certain temperature regime, you know, a swing from a certain low temperature to high temperature. And all of those particular environments are moving poleward. They're moving poleward or they're moving up in altitude. So there's definitely migrations going on. Human migrations, yes. But I suspect that most of the human migrations will be from rising sea level. Well over a billion people live within 25 meters of present sea level, and hundreds of millions live within about a meter. So countries like Bangladesh, parts of Europe, there's many, many cities on coasts. And, you know, this is another separate topic. Hansen thinks that we'll have up to 5 meters of sea level rise by 2100. My estimate is higher. I'm saying 7 meters by 2070. And again, this would be another show to discuss, you know, how I'm coming up with those numbers. But we do know, you know, the models on sea level rise aren't the way to go. You look at what happened in history. You look at the other warm periods on the planet. For example, the Eemian 130,000 years ago, sea levels were 4 to 6 meters higher. Average temperatures were only about a degree higher. If you go to the Pliocene, where it was 2-3 degrees warmer, sea levels were 25 meters higher. Even at the end of the last ice age, I mean, the sea level has been fairly stable for the last 7,000 years, except since 1750, 1800, and, you know, now the rates are climbing. But there are periods since the last ice age when sea level rose about a meter every 20 years, and this happened over several centuries. So that's 5 meter rise in sea level per century, and this happened over 2 or 3 centuries. And we know this. In fact, when sea level stabilized around 7,000 years ago and didn't rise that much more, then coastlines became much more, the fish on coastlines became much more abundant. It allowed people to live near the coastlines and get high food. You know, it was very easy to get food from fishing. So this allowed, you know, the first cities that formed when civilization was developing, it was every, you know, the entire group of people didn't have to scavenge and hunt for food. They could just fish and get it. So then people had time to do other things. So civilization, there's a strong case that Hansen makes that when sea levels stabilized, that was a big factor in development of civilization. So sea level rise is, you know, a huge factor, and, you know, it's a very nonlinear factor. I mean, we know the melt rates are going up significantly. You know, if the Arctic sea ice is gone in 2016, according to the Maslowski model, you know, for the first time in September, you know, we're going to get a skyrocketing of temperature in the Arctic, you know, above and beyond what we've seen, and this can, you know, this will soften ice shells vanish, they no longer buttress the ice caps, and we can get very massive increases in sea level rise back to, and this has happened. I mean, we have the numbers from the paleo records, so you know, that's going to be the cause of most of the human migration.
Well, that pretty well agrees with what we heard last week from our guest from Berlin, Jochen Hinkel, who was talking about the huge costs in their report that they did for the Global Climate Forum of rising sea levels, and he said he thought that would be the single biggest impact of climate change, and that sea level would drive people around rather than the heat. I mean, people live in Saudi Arabia right now, and as long as we can keep the air conditioners going, I guess people will try to adapt to the heat, although I doubt that our food supply will adapt to it. We've got to wrap it up there, Paul. I want to thank you so much for joining us. Paul is from the University of Ottawa. Don't miss his super active Facebook page, which is almost a climate news service in itself. I'll put links to Paul and his work in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Paul, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Authorities say two people were injured when a major natural gas pipeline exploded in flames overnight in a town 90 miles south of Louisville. Officials said it's a tough day to lose the giant 30-inch pipeline that carries natural gas from the Gulf of Mexico to the Northeast and Midwest.
While D.C. is not facing an alien attack, there is reason to fear explosion in the nation's capital. Why? Well, researchers have found about 6,000 natural gas leaks under the roads in the District of Columbia. At least 12 of them are potentially explosive. Duke and Boston University researchers drove down every street of D.C. to measure the leaks. Most are said to not pose any risk to the general public. However, they could add to climate change.
Scientists cruising around in Boston and Washington, D.C. discovered large amounts of natural gas, basically methane, leaking out of city pipelines. Safety's obviously a concern, but so is the claim that natural gas is a better fossil fuel option than coal. We're joined by one of the principals in these studies, Dr. Nathan Phillips, and a professor at Boston University. Dr. Phillips, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
That Boston study came first. Why did you do it?
Well, it's a case of serendipity in science. I really was not studying this topic until by accident I met someone who was looking at gas leaks a couple blocks away from my home outside of Boston. And that's where I learned about the problem. I learned that it damages trees, and I study trees. That's my specialty. And from there, the other aspects of these leaking gas pipelines became apparent very quickly, including the global greenhouse gas impact.
I didn't know it damaged trees. What happens to them?
The gas displaces oxygen in the root zone, and the roots need oxygen to, like we need to breathe, the roots need, you know, oxygen, and without it, they asphyxiate. So that damages the trees and other vegetation.
So how does a person or a team of scientists go about measuring natural gas leaking in a major American city?
It used to be difficult. In the last 5 or 10 years, it's become much simpler. The instrumentation that allows us to measure high-precision methane has improved to the point that it can be mobile. So if you think about what Google, for example, has done with their Street View vehicles, you can think about the environmental measurements basically being on pace with that. So methane and going forward, temperature, ozone, other types of measurements will now be linked with GPS and be available from drive-arounds.
Should we presume that natural gas leaks are worse in the older East Coast cities where the pipes were laid maybe even in the late 1800s than, say, in a newer suburb in the West?
All things equal, I would say yes. However, it really depends on the specific conditions, particularly environmental conditions. If there's a lot of freeze-thaw cycles, those things can have an impact even if the age of the pipe is not as old. And so all things are not equal between cities. So I hesitate to make a categorical claim that it's worse in the East Coast cities.
So how serious were some of the leaks that you discovered?
Well, both in Boston and Washington, D.C., in terms of seriousness, there's a couple dimensions to that. As you noted in the introduction, there's human health and safety, so explosion risks, and that's right at the point of the leak. And then there's the greenhouse gas issue, which is, you know, a global issue. There's also an intermediate scale, kind of the regional scale, which relates to air pollution, ozone, and other pollutants that are stimulated or promoted by natural gas leaks. And so these things are all playing out in these different cities. We've seen all of those impacts.
And I gather some were big enough that they could have become an explosion. Did you report those dangerous leaks to the authorities, and what happened?
Yes, those are what are called in the U.S. grade 1 leaks. So they are potentially explosive leaks. And when we did come across those, we reported them, and the utilities are required to respond in very short order to those, and they have, and they addressed those to their credit. I should say that in the studies that the Washington, D.C. and Boston studies, we didn't set out to do a comprehensive examination of explosive situations. So the few or handful of situations that we did report in both of those papers were really more of an ad hoc ancillary collection where we happened to note that there were explosive conditions. So what I'm getting at is that there's probably many more existing conditions that are explosive in those cities and other cities as we speak.
Now, we can't see or smell methane, as far as I know. So do natural gas companies add a warning smell to their product as they do with propane?
Yes, and this is a class of sulfur compounds called mercaptans that are added into the gas. It's kind of some people liken it to a rotten egg smell, but it's definitely a distinct odor that is put into the gas.
And how many pipeline leaks did you find? Was it like a dozen or 100 or more?
Well, it's on the order of thousands in Boston as well as in Washington, D.C. So in Boston, we had close to 4,000, and in Washington, D.C., we had close to 6,000. Those kind of were proportional roughly to the total length of pipelines in those two cities. So they're about the same density or number of leaks per mile in the two cities. If anything, the Washington, D.C. leak values, at the surface level at least, the concentration of gas were higher, so they seemed to be more intense.
Now, the first I heard about these leaky city gas systems, I think it was about Baltimore, from Robert Howarth of Cornell. He estimated methane losses in the whole system from fracking wells through storage units, which also leak, to city delivery. And Howarth got a lot of heat for that. Others at his university even tried to discredit his work. Have you had any pushback?
Well, no, we haven't had any pushback, because I think the findings that we've had are really not something that can be disputed. They're either we did see those leaks or we didn't, and the data either is showing these spikes on the roads or they're not. And so we're confident in the measurements that we made. And Professor Howarth, his work was valuable in being the first paper to really put the question out there. But because it was so early, he had to rely on very limited direct data measurements and use estimates that had been made. And from those, he concluded that we may have a serious issue with this. In our work, we went out and actually measured the number of leaks. And so that really, you know, just constrains the problem a whole lot more on our end. So, no, we haven't really gotten the kind of pushback that you were discussing.
Well, you know, the gas companies must know how much they're losing. They could just calculate the amount coming into a major metropolitan market versus the actual amounts they bill for. Did you manage to get any of those figures? Does anybody have those figures, or does it matter for this study?
Yes, we do have those figures, and those are publicly available through the Department of Transportation, and that's called a lost and unaccounted for gas. The problem is that it's a black box that is composed of three different categories. One is accounting errors, two is metering errors, and three are leaks from the pipeline system. The problem is that it's some combination of those three things, and we don't know how to partition that overall lost and unaccounted for gas into those three components. So our work on the leak side is something which we hope to clarify that aspect of it, and know what percentage of the total lost and unaccounted for gas there is. But in a state like Massachusetts, the amount of reported lost and unaccounted for gas can be up to 8% of the entire state's greenhouse gas inventory. So the stakes are very high to resolve this question.
Right. And how does these natural gas leaks fit into the overall methane releases in the United States?
Well, we don't know. What we've done so far is to document that there are a great number of leaks in urban areas and suburbs. We've also documented that some of those leaks, a selection of those leaks, can individually be significant in the amount of gas that's coming out of individual leaks, sometimes multiples of times of the daily household average gas consumption. But we don't have the number as to what all of those leaks in a metropolitan area add up to and how that compares with the overall lost estimates from the entire process chain. As I said, the amount of lost and unaccounted for gas just from the distribution systems, so that's the city and suburb neighborhood pipeline systems, can add up to a large component of the entire state's greenhouse gas inventory. So it is potentially significant.
Now, you mentioned Massachusetts, and I know Representative Markey has put forward a bill to try and get some pressure on the companies to fix it and maybe some public money to help them fix it. From a public policy perspective, what do you think politicians can do to address this problem?
Well, that's Senator Markey I think you're now referencing. And yes, the infrastructure that we have is aging. And I think that one of the things that needs to be a kind of a prerequisite to addressing this problem is for there to be a sense of shared ownership about this publicly regulated infrastructure, which, you know, is in some cases pipelines over 100 years old. It's easy to point the finger at the utility and say it's all of their problem and they have to fix the whole thing, you know, but this is really, you know, a kind of a commons. It's our infrastructure. And I think that, you know, there may be some combination of ratepayers and the utilities and the investors that have to come up with a joint solution, because it is really a shared issue.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. Nathan Phillips of Boston University. We are talking about scientific studies showing an alarming number of natural gas pipeline leaks right in major American cities. And we have been talking about America here, but I remember when global atmosphere campaigners were working away on where the methane was coming from, they found a hell of a lot of it was coming from Russian pipelines that were leaking all the way from Siberia and going west. Have you heard anything about that?
Well, that was implicated, I think, as far back or even earlier than the mid-90s. And I don't have any direct knowledge of updates on that. I just would say that any old city with aging infrastructure, based on my experience, is, you know, something that should be checked for pipeline leaks.
Well, right, and we should be talking here about Britain, where gas started lighting the cities in the 1800s, and continental Europe. Have any European academics contacted you or started similar investigations?
Yes, and certainly there have been, and academics as well as news organizations. This issue pops up when there are explosions, and that's often the triggering factor for inquiries. And so several months ago in Prague, there was a building explosion that was related to natural gas. It happens, you know, not infrequently, and this is where the inquiries get made. One of the things that I always look for are manhole explosions. That's the number one underappreciated diagnostic, I believe, of underground pipeline leak problems or potential problems. And these are something that pop up in the news frequently from place to place and are an indicator that there's a problem underground.
Yeah, there's a whole YouTube genre of nothing but natural gas explosion videos. There's one just in Kentucky that blew out a major line, and there's even a video game where you can have your character try and dodge the blowing manhole covers. So I'm wondering, though, in the bigger picture, the studies that you and Rob Jackson and other scientists did, how do they fit into this debate about whether natural gas is a good bridge fuel, say, to replace coal?
Well, I think that they point to the need, you know, to address our infrastructure, our existing infrastructure. So much of the emphasis seems to be on building out new infrastructure. And, you know, I kind of liken that to having leaks in one's roof and yet being focused on making new additions to the house with a new roof somewhere or addition. And we really have to address our existing infrastructure, know what the leak rate is, and address it before we spend so much time thinking about putting out new infrastructure and new infrastructure that should have lifetimes of many, many decades. And so when we talk about natural gas as a bridge fuel, well, how many decades are we talking about for using this gas and investing in long-lived infrastructure versus using it truly as a currency to allow us to get to renewable fuels?
Well, you know, eastern cities like Boston have taken a winter pounding this year. Americans must be burning more natural gas this winter. Would that mean more is leaking out of these pipelines into the atmosphere?
Not necessarily. It's possible, but it's not necessarily the case. And that's because these distribution systems, pipeline systems, are pressure regulated. So essentially, the pressure is maintained at a certain level. And if demand goes up, more gas is put into the system, but it's maintained at the same pressure. Just like a tire on a bike is at a certain pressure, and if you have a hole in that tire, it's going to leak out at a certain rate. If you maintain that pressure, it's going to leak out at the same rate. Now, there could be a little bit of a nuance to that in that sometimes they have to overpressurize the system in the winter just to kind of get a little bit ahead of the demand, and there may be, in those cases, a somewhat enhanced leak rate.
Will you be doing studies of more gas leaks in more cities, or is this something that the cities and the utilities should be doing themselves now?
Well, I think that it's a combination of both. So some of the legislation in Massachusetts puts requirements on the utilities for more stringent gas leak surveys. I do believe that there should be a role for independent audits and leak surveys by, you know, a third party, and that that's an important check, you know, and verification on the problem. So I do think that this is going to become much more common, and other independent groups will be doing gas leak surveys because the price and ease of doing this is becoming more easy, and it's becoming cheaper to do so. So that's going to continue to happen. It's becoming more transparent. I think the cat's out of the bag with regard to these surveys, and so it's only going to increase the pressure to address the problem.
Now, I'd like to ask your personal opinion about something. When we look at the dire consequences of a relatively rapid climate shift, are you personally worried about the future of university students, and is it your sense that young people are also concerned about it?
Yeah, I'm concerned. You know, I think that I say that, you know, in the climate reports from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, one of the most prevalent words is uncertainty. Some people take uncertainty as a reason not to act because we're not certain that there's going to be serious consequences of climate change. But for me, it's exactly the opposite. When I, you know, see that uncertainty, it makes me think that we really need to be precautionary about our future. And, you know, our students are going to be inheriting that future, and so they need to be equally concerned. And I get a lot of inspiration from my students because I find that they are taking this issue much more seriously than some of the people from my own generation who, you know, really ought to be taking it more seriously.
Is there anything that I've missed that you would like to tell our listeners?
Well, I think that addressing the problem of the leaking gas pipes, we have to think about our infrastructure as a kind of integrated ecosystem of infrastructure. Our water pipes, our gas pipes, our electrical pipes. A lot of this infrastructure is co-located on or under our streets or above our streets. And often the way our cities work, the way we manage our cities, is that we'll address one piece of it at the exclusion of the others. And sometimes you can actually exacerbate problems in one by addressing the problems of the others. So we really need to coordinate our infrastructure so that when we replace a leaking water pipe, we check to see if there's a 100-year-old gas pipe. If there is, let's replace that at the same time. And so I think there are cost savings, there are opportunities that we can look for and be more smart about our cities and maintaining our infrastructure.
Yeah, I think there's a tendency as citizens to pretend this underground world doesn't exist, as though trees don't have roots, and our cities certainly have a lot of roots going around in there. Our guest has been Dr. Nathan G. Phillips from Boston University. He's co-author of the papers Mapping Urban Pipeline Leaks, Methane Leaks Across Boston, and Natural Gas Pipeline Leaks Across Washington, D.C. That one was just published in the January 16th edition of the journal Environmental Science and Technology. Nathan, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith.
Radio EcoShock.
Next week, we'll look at the California water supply and scientists worrying we are on the road to the worst of possible climate worlds. Don't forget you can find links to everything we've talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. That's published every Wednesday. My special thanks to all the listeners who support this show and support their nonprofit community radio stations. Find out more at our website, ecoshock.org. I'm Alex. Thank you for listening.